Accession number 10033, reel number 2.
I think we had a better chance to be converted onto the four-engined plane flying and had more of it, rather than fighter planes, the smaller fighter planes. We travelled north, principally, to ferry, deliver aircraft, and as various pools delivered, we actually delivered to the pools for unferrying to remoter places in Scotland and the north. So it was mostly the main routes. And we came in contact, of course, with a lot of this balloon corridor between Liverpool and Manchester, which was very unpleasant. I was balloons officer, so I had to mark balloons every day, so perhaps it was better for me than some others.
They changed the positions of the balloons all the time?
Mm. The ones they did, you marked in.
How did you hear what the changes were?
It was an official bulletin each morning. You went to a map and put these red drawing pins in.
How dangerous was it flying through near the balloons?
Well, we used to have a lot of industrial haze between Manchester and Liverpool when the wind drifted either the Liverpool haze to Manchester or the Manchester haze across, when visibility was really very, very bad, but only up to a certain height. But then we weren't supposed to fly above a certain height. So if you stuck to the regulations, you were in a mile-wide balloon corridor in very poor visibility, say about 300 yards. And that was very eerie. And there was no way. Sometimes they had red flags on the balloon cables. And on one occasion, I did see a red flag flash past on my left.
Did you ever have any accidents?
Minor ones. The tail wheel broke on landing, which made me stop in the middle of the aerodrome. It wasn't a heavy landing. It apparently had been weakened previously, as was proved in the accident. It was the accident committee who went over every accident afterwards, in which I sat several times. And I'm afraid, collided with another pilot. It was a very small, obscure airport, and we both landed from different directions. There were two windsocks, and we mistook the wind. And we didn't do a lot of damage, but I'm afraid it was my fault, considered my fault. I was rather nervous then that would be the end of my flying, but fortunately they were kind. And then I had a rather unpleasant accident when a rather unusual Wellington with Rolls-Royce engines, which they didn't usually have, which caused a swing to one unusual side as you took off. Swung. You did expect to, but this swung a different way to the other one. And it did the slight swing, which I was putting down to the difference in engine, and it turned out to be a failure of that engine on takeoff when I hadn't attained a very safe speed. And there was no alternative but to pull all the emergency cocks I could, which didn't take any effect, and it was a petrol blockage. And I was forced to land in fields and just near a small village whose power line I cut. And we landed in the field, minus bits and pieces and broken back. Unfortunately, I had three passengers. One girl had a broken back, and one girl had cuts, and there's a man in the plane as well, actually, and he and I both suffered cuts and bruises, but we were walked away safely. But it was a very good service. The airport had seen us go down, and within a quarter of an hour they were there, and everybody recovered in time from the accident. But even the girl with a broken spine, it mended all okay.
What about your confidence?
Oh, very shaken indeed. I didn't think I could have done anything else, but you always say to yourself, could I have?
Was there a committee of inquiry about
that
one?
Yes, yes. And I wasn't blamed.
How soon did you fly again?
Well, a taxi plane came to pick I and the other chap who was uninjured up. And it was a junior pilot flying, and it was my prerogative to fly it back. And I thought if I didn't do that, I'd never fly again. So I did fly it back. I felt very unhappy about that. And I felt unhappy about flying for some while afterwards.
Did you receive any treatment for shock or nerves?
No, I just had to go on flying, I felt. No, I wasn't hurt, really, except bruised. My finger was knocked back a bit. But I could fly. I was medically adequate. But I had to make an effort to fly.
And what about flying that type of aeroplane again?
I would rather not have ever done it again, but I had to. It was a very safe aircraft as a whole. And I had another accident where the oil system failed in a very dicey kind of plane that everybody had been warned about. And I was flying over the sea at Blackpool, the Isle of Man, and which is a shortcut we used to take. And because it seemed to be functioning perfectly, and funny noises started happening, the oil pressure started to drop. So I turned back to the nearest airport. I reached it and went straight into land, only to find there was something else landing because it had an unusual circuit. Sometimes they had a left-hand rather than the right-hand circuit. And I hadn't been able to fly over to have a look at the letters outside the watch office. And so I had no option. The oil completely failed, and so everything started to judder and shake and frightful noise. So I shut off everything and landed with the wheels up on the grass beside the airport. Fortunately, it was very pleasant, just like a toboggan run. And it didn't do the aircraft much good. Not much harm either. And me, no harm at all. That didn't take my confidence away. I think it was having other people hurt in the plane with me.
And was it felt that you'd done the right thing?
For that one? Yes. There wasn't any option.
What were the chief dangers, the chief hazards?
Trying to deliver a plane in weather which was unfit for flying. Because we had priority aircraft. When you got a senior, you were given priority aircraft, which you were allowed to fly under any condition you thought you could fly it in. And if they were mosquitoes, just the beginning of the bombing, or a bomber, one felt that one should try one's very best to get it in. And if you felt there was any way that you could get it in, such as flying up a railway line low, you did so. And I think a lot of people met trouble that way.
Did you ever feel there was pressure on you?
You mean I was forced to do it by my seniors? Reverse. You were left entirely on your own. You were master of your own fate. Entirely. You must do as you think fit was rather the attitude.
How well do you think that system worked?
Very well indeed, I think. Very well indeed, because I think the people who weren't experienced were responsible people who were quite nervous. I mean, my husband, for instance, always says to me, "Why are you so careful? I thought pilots were reckless people." Or he used to say that. But that's not right. It might have been right in the First World War, but not in the ferry pilots, as far as I can speak. I would say people were very nervous to do the right thing and what they thought they could do.
Can you tell me about how it came about you were moved on to the four-engined planes?
Well, it was my object in life. And as people in our pool started it, naturally I did everything I could to help. I became test pilot and balloon pilot. And it was sort of a natural sequence of events that I would eventually go on to four.
What was the test pilot's duties?
Any plane that came in where someone either left it because there was something wrong with it for the maintenance unit, or because they hadn't got their own pilots, we tested it, and provided it was ATA, and any pilot, a junior pilot, who thought something wasn't quite up to the standard, we usually tested it on the ground, or necessary flying. And I was allocated to do that.
How frequently would you have to test a plane?
2 or 3 a month, maybe. Sometimes it was nothing that you thought dangerous.
How dangerous was it for you to test a plane that was suspect?
Not dangerous at all, because I wouldn't have... One only worried me. I wouldn't have flown it if I'd thought it wasn't right. I'd have just gone on saying it wasn't right until I thought it was fit.
What happened with the one that did worry you?
It was a Mitchell, B-25, American bomber, came in from Scotland with a pilot who said that the oil pressure was inadequate, wasn't up to the standard. And it happened when it got warm. It was originally all right on the ground. And they changed the oil, they did everything they could, and they said that as far as they could see, it was all right, but they couldn't sit it running on the ground too long. Would I fly it? So I flew it with one of the maintenance units and engineers. And after 20 minutes, it seemed silly, really, because the delivery place was only about half an hour away. But they said, no, I must test fly, not deliver it faulty. So I flew it round, and sure enough, after 20 minutes, the oil pressure dropped below the acceptable rate. So we just had to land again, leave it to the maintenance unit.
And did you have a difficult landing?
No, it was perfectly right. It's not doing any harm. It may have been a faulty gauge.
Tell me then, when you went to learn to fly the four engines.
We went to Yorkshire, Marston Moor. And the instructor was an American, a commercial pilot. And I was very overawed, very nervous. We stayed at a local pub. The weather wasn't good, so it was intermittent flying. He frightened me somewhat, because I was flying at dusk on one day, and he said to me, look at your starboard outer exhaust. So I looked, and it was bright red. And I'd never, of course, only done day flying, and he knew that. And apparently that does happen sometimes at night. It gets hot, and it shows up, and I thought something awful to happen. Do you want me to shut it down and feather it, which has stopped? And he said, laughed, roared with laughter. Treated it as a great joke. It terrified me, though. Apparently it was quite normal. And I think everything else. I felt I was totally inadequate to fly the plane when I left. He said I was adequate. It was all right. I passed. I felt totally inadequate. I really couldn't cope with it, with all the troubles that could have happened. I was very frightened of it.
What were the differences on progressing onto four-engine bombers?
Well, in a way, it was easier because you had four dials to look at on everything, and if one altered from the others, you realised something was wrong with it. You didn't have to keep looking at four. You just noticed there was any difference. You used to call it 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. You used to see it. It was heavy. The Halifax was very heavy. Much heavier to fly, I thought. And also, of course, a penalty for mistake. It's a heavier plane than dropping it all, not landing low enough or going too low in a bounce would be magnified. Also, you felt you were flying something more valuable to the country. You were very conscious, made very conscious that you were flying plane, and your chief worry was getting the plane down in one bit rather than yourself, although they both worked out that way. But I never liked the Halifax. But when we went back to the station, we were required to fly 6 Halifaxes before we were allowed to fly a Lancaster. And then we flew a Lancaster without having flown it before, and which worried me, the idea. But I found it amazingly easy after Halifax. We had a woman engineer at that station at the time. Oops. That was quite a sensation wherever we landed. More the engineer than the pilot.
How many women learnt to fly 4-engine bombers?
There were 12 qualified, but two of them didn't fly them. She's wrong. That's this book tells you.
So there were 10 actually flying.
As far as I knew, you see, because I didn't know who flew at Waltham or at Hamble.
And did you get a strange reaction when you arrived with such a large plane?
Oh, yes. I think the small taxi plane, they used to follow you around at that point because it was very vital that you should. You know, there were very few four-engine pilots, and we had quite a lot of factories to take from, so that you had to be back. So you were followed around by your own plane, which picked up other people, or you picked up other people if you came back with a four-engine plane. And I think you got a certain prestige. You felt a great satisfaction. And I was used to look up and think, well, I couldn't have believed I'd ever fly that. And that I would ever fly it competently. And I always treated it with the greatest respect and all.
Did you like, you liked flying the Lancaster?
The plane I liked flying was Mosquito.
Did it make any, were there any problems as regards a woman flying a four-engine bomber in terms of size, the layout of the cockpit?
Some planes, we weren't supposed to fly Liberators, although I see that Lettice Curtis says she did, but she's taller than me. And a lot of the Americans' planes had brakes on the rudder rather than on the handle. And there are some smaller fighter planes which people under 5'7" were not supposed to fly, such as a Mustang. For that reason, that your reach wasn't sufficient. We didn't fly any flying boats at all. There were very few, and there were some professional pilots who did. Other than that, I flew a Fortress, which was not difficult. One. I think they were very much heavier, and I think you felt overawed, always. I had the greatest of respect for a four-engine plane.
You had to have a flight engineer with you?
Yes.
What was his or her duties?
Well, they had to work. They helped you take off. As you took off with the throttles, up to a certain point and control the swing, when you got it under control, then they fully opened up, because it's very wide. It wasn't that a woman couldn't reach it, but it's very difficult to sort of go on controlling. Once you're up to a certain extent, they finished opening up. And when you were landing, you needed a great feel on the stick. It was altogether bigger, and as you cut the throttles, they did the final cut. If you set it, they took your command.
How confident did you feel
they
in your
They put
flight?
The flaps down and they did things for you.
How confident did you feel in your flight engineers?
Very, very, yes. I think everybody was very well trained. They weren't able to, nobody really was sent on to anything they couldn't do, especially if they got up to that level.
Once you'd converted to four engines, did you find you were flying proportionately more of the larger planes?
No. You still had a lot of factories to deliver, and if there were any priorities, you were sure to be given it, because you were more able to get through.
How long did you stay at Cosford?
I think I shall have to.
How long did you stay at Cosford?
Until the end of the war, when Cosford as such was closed down, and we were transferred for a few months to White Waltham pending our closure of the ATA.
What rank were you by this time?
Flight captain. Which meant two stripes and a little one in the middle.
What did a flight captain do?
Well, I suppose you didn't do anything very much, but you were in command of most of the others at the pool, except for the head of the pool commander and the flight captain, who was the second in command.
What were your duties once Cosford had shut down and you'd transferred back to White Waltham?
I flew whatever was necessary. There were still planes to collect and take to be broken up. And from factories, still went on making them tentatively. And there wasn't an awful lot to do. One set about rather a lot. Taxi plane service still worked. And then we also had flights to the continent, avoiding the pockets of resistance which still existed in two ports, I think, in France. And mostly, personally, I did entirely blood plasma to Czechoslovakia. And we had to, of course, land and stay overnight on the way, probably twice, and for refueling, and we were able to land at RAF aerodromes, and also run by the RAF. We didn't land at foreign, French or any other aerodromes, but there were a lot of aerodromes manned by the Americans, and we landed there. And Nuremberg was one I remember, and Brussels was usually our usual stop. And then we were told on the first flight, if when we landed in Prague or Pilsen, we saw Russian soldiers, we were to immediately take off again, whatever the wind. We were Nansens, it was easy. And if we saw American soldiers, that was all right.
Did you ever see any Russian soldiers?
No.
Were you worried about going into Europe?
No, I was a bit worried about the flying, but I found it very easy. The rivers are larger and the railways were less frequent. Easy flying.
How adequate were the maps you had?
Good, at the bigger end of the war. Although I'm told at the beginning of the war that the before the actual war started all over France, and I'm told by pilots, I wasn't in the 80 then, that they were flying by postcards, because there weren't any maps that they had.
What did you think of what you saw in Europe?
Shocked. Really, terribly shocked. How accurate the bombing was. The centres of the cities were just rubble. It got a little better on the peripheries, and wasn't all right till right outside the city. They were dead accurate. Particularly the American bombing of Frankfurt, Cologne. Dreadful. When we stopped at Nuremberg, we were driven through the streets to where we were going to stay. And it was dreadful. The devastation was quite dreadful. And people were just leaning out of broken windows with mattresses and pillows leaning on them, looking out. And obviously the whole house was completely open to the weathers.
Did you meet any of the local
population? Quite shocked, really.
Did you meet any of the
local? No, we didn't.
And what was Czechoslovakia like?
Comparatively all right. I don't think we bombed there, did we? Very much didn't appear so. I suppose the airports. I didn't ever notice anything.
What about short supplies?
Well, we weren't there long. We came straight back with the same plane, you see, empty.
Did you... You went out with a group of people?
No, on our own. But the main towns that were bombed were... I just felt deep shock. I knew we had to do it, but it was dreadful what we did. When you had no idea and you saw it. I suppose I'd felt the same if I'd fled out of the country.
You were taking blood plasma, medical supplies?
Yes. The plane was full up with all kinds of blood plasma. That was our chief, sometimes food.
Did you bring anybody back with you?
No. And we were never asked to do that.
Approximately how many trips did you make?
Well, I think only about six. That was six. And I had one very amusing flight. I took, twice, I took Lysander, which is a very short takeoff landing. And they used to drop the Free French in the war. And they had ladders, the ones in the war had ladders down the side, an extra petrol tax. And the pilots, I'm told, used to fly into fields and slow down, and the Free French used to get down the ladder before they stopped. They used to take off again without having to go back into a field. And this kind of plane, therefore, as you see, is very slow in landing, taking off, very quick lift. And I delivered several of those to the French postal services, aerial postal services in France, when it was more or less a sort of a volunteer job. When you delivered it, you had to find your own way home. And you obviously delivered it somewhere which had planes and tried to get a lift to somewhere where there was an American base and get back in American planes. Because there were more American planes stationed there than English, or English if you could. You had to hitchhike your way back, and we did that a lot. It was great fun.
Did Did it worry you, hitchhiking around Europe?
No, it was great.
How dangerous was it?
No, not. It was only from France.
You were in uniform?
Yes. And you don't think of danger much when you're young, do you? I do it much more now.
What happened when ATA finally closed down?
Well, I felt I couldn't give up flying entirely, although I felt I'd done all I wanted to do, really. But I didn't want to give it up, so I took a commercial license, which entailed me going back to school to learn more about maths and spherical angles, because a commercial license really entitles you to fly the Atlantic as a sort of big plane with all the wireless aids you've got, and you've got to learn spherical angles to transfer onto the courses. And I hadn't done that maths at school at all, so I had to go in for it again, and it used to rather humiliate me to be in with classes where there were sergeant pilots who knew it all. They'd gone through it all at school. They were younger than me, much younger. Anyway, we did the exams and I managed to get through, but it's a much less complicated exam than it would be now. And I then got a job, and they wouldn't let me fly passengers with Olsen Shipping Lines, who were stationed at Croydon under the name of Chartair Limited. And they flew trip flights and things to Malta and places, and in the Mediterranean. And they landed back at Croydon and delivered their passengers through customs. And I had the job of ferrying all their planes to the maintenance depot at Tame and back, which meant I sort of got there at midnight and had to find my way back. And it was quite fun. In between, I used to do the loading licenses and do clerical work as well.
Were you allowed to fly to the Mediterranean?
No, because they carried passengers. I wasn't allowed to. Women wouldn't have been allowed then to carry passengers.
How difficult was it to get a job at all as a woman
pilot? Very.
How did you feel about that, having flown so many planes?
I accepted it. Because after all, you have to remember that in the ATA, it was A1. They were A1 women, medically, and physically in every way, whereas the men were either too old to fly war planes for fighting, or they were incapacitated medically in some way or other. So really, medically, the women were very much fitter than the men. For this reason, I would have thought they were about equal, but I would personally always prefer to be flown by a man pilot. Although I think women can fly as well as a whole, I think it needs a strength and the quickness of mind and the more singleness of mind that a man has.
Did you ever receive any commendation for the work that you had done?
Yes, at the end of the war I had a medal which was for valuable service in the air, which I value very much.
Was it specified exactly what your service had been?
No, it was a rather general medal, if you know what I mean. Like the people who served in Burma. Perhaps a little less general, but on that line. It was given to only a few people.
How do you feel now about the time you spent in ATA?
I think it was an absolutely wonderful privilege, which I don't think women will ever achieve again. If you speak now to a Concorde pilot or any BOAC who talk about flying, they treat it with great respect, they envy you enormously, and they don't think that women will ever have that chance again. And the women, after all, who fly now as commercial pilots with BOAC have done enormous hours already. So they are highly qualified pilots.